Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Dan's weekly integration call. I'm Megan, Dr. Dan's sister, and I will be hosting the call today. Today's call will be 75 minutes, and we will cover some of the submitted questions, and Dr. Dan will speak on the theme for this month that covers one of the many aspects of full spectrum medicine. This call is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or the giving of medical advice. For questions or for more information, please email us at admin@drdaningle.com. Okay, let's get started. Dr. Dan, turning it over now to you to add anything before we dive in.
Thanks everybody for joining in. Another Wednesday afternoon, another week has already flown by. Feels like a lot has just even happened since our last Wednesday call. And I pulsed the group last time. I see some familiar faces, and I think a few people might be new or at least weren't joining us for last week's call, and we're going to continue through a series. Sonia just put a doc in the chat box to link as an overview of what we're going to be going over and covering in this series. So about 6 weeks ago, we wrapped up a conversation on suffering and the causes of suffering. And then that led into a conversation around happiness and what are the different formulas for happiness. If you go into the bookstore, or at least now the virtual bookstore, and you look on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction books, over the last couple of years, there's consistently been books on happiness. The happiness equation, 10% happier, 10x happier, I think there's probably half a dozen that have come out in the last two, maybe 3 years. So there's a lot of different formulas. This isn't a new conversation. It is a new conversation for us in that we're putting together this formula of happiness. And to the best of my knowledge, the formula or the outline that I'm giving you for happiness isn't elsewhere. So by nature, out of the gate, it's already new information. I'll give you a little bit of an update just for those joining again to bring you up to speed really quickly on how that map got codified. And another thing that makes it new is that we're talking about happiness in the context of awakening experiences, happiness in the context of the hero and the heroine's journey that you're all on at some point and some stage of development. And as it relates to happiness going into the shadow material in order to reclaim one of our parts or a larger part of ourself or to get more connected with our soul, then by design, it is a hero and a heroine's journey, whether you knew or not that that's what you were embarking on. And oftentimes we don't know exactly what's going to happen. That is also by design, because if the ego knew what was going to happen, it would say, hell no, we're not going to do that, because the ego doesn't want to let go of control. So brief recap on last week. Let me just go over the system real quick. So it's a 7-layered system. It mirrors and matches the 7 primary energetic centers of the body. And all major wisdom traditions extended from medical teachings that have spanned time, i.e. over thousands of years, included discussion of the energetics of the human physiology. So we're talking primarily around Ayurveda from India, Ayurvedic medicine, that is. We're talking about Chinese medicine, more around the traditional Chinese medicine around acupuncture meridians, essentially like ley lines of the body, and Egyptian medicine. And Egyptian medicine being aware of the energetics as well as the soul aspects. They talk about the tripartite soul, the soul being connected to the mind and heart, connected to the body, and connected to the spirit. So as it relates primarily in the reference that we're most familiar with as a culture today, extends out of yogic philosophy, which is a compendium, so to speak, or a complement to the chakra system of the body. These are essentially described or translated as wheels of energy or wheels of life. And when you look at these different energy centers, they are also mapping out the major organs and glands of the body. So I'm not going to go too much into the esoteric physiology. What we're talking about here are more of the energetic characteristics particularly as they relate to fundamental drives and needs across humanity, across culture, across age, across socioeconomic status, across levels of consciousness. I mean, it doesn't matter where you're at in your own process. These are fundamental drives and needs of the human experience towards happiness. So that's the background of the map. Level one that we talked about last week is essentially around the first level, similar to Maslow's hierarchy. You have to solidify safety and security first. So safety is the drive, security is the need. And when those are solidified in their positive expression or in their healthy expression, a person will experience safety and security, and then their relationship with life and themselves is abundance. So feeling that life is abundant, feeling that life is generative, feeling that life is continuously offering us what we need in order to do the work that we're here to do, in order to be grounded and centered in who we are, recognizing that we have the opportunity to be empowered for our choices and towards our outcomes of desired manifestation. All of these things, when we are in a more abundant flow or experience with life, life starts to happen more easily. We've used this term a lot in the past, more easily with the recognition that it's happening for me instead of to me. The complement to abundance is scarcity. And again, these aren't necessarily good or bad. They're just human experiences. We've all experienced abundance. We've all experienced scarcity, sometimes moment to moment. You don't inhabit each at the same time. You may toggle between both very quickly, and that might seem as if you're experiencing both simultaneously. But the nervous system is similar. You're not in sympathetic dominance or parasympathetic dominance at the same time. You're not in fight or flight or rest and relaxation at the same time. You might toggle fairly quickly. When people stress their nervous system, it actually takes them a while to go more dominant into parasympathetics. And we have the opportunity to actually shift our nervous system by shifting our perspective. And again, this isn't rocket science either, and it's not new science either. More and more, the new science is speaking about it more actively, because it's a message that can't be told enough. It's hard to overstate the fact that we own our own perspective. And so when we shift our perspective from abundance, and this is where we have choice, regardless of the outside influence or evidence, we get to choose. Am I living a life of abundance or am I living a life of scarcity? That's really hard to embody when somebody's in pain, when somebody's being threatened, when somebody's basic needs aren't met, which means their security. In a war zone, it's really hard to feel abundant. And what I mean, abundance just by itself, if you look at the definition, is a pretty neutral term. It essentially just means a lot of something. We tend to, in our culture and society, in the lexicon of abundance, we tend to associate abundance with a positive attribute. And so I'm using that now. So the complement to scarcity, which is a contractive force, is the opening. And you could think of abundance as also being open. Essentially, I'm open to life. So we might use more specific languaging if we were to talk about scarcity versus openness. But in the usual verbiage, so to speak, more people have an association with abundance to mean something positive, and that means I experience the gratitude and the appreciation for what's in my life and here. So that lays a foundation. And it's really hard to build on a foundation that's wobbly. So we solidify the foundation of beingness in an experience of openness, in an experience of abundance. Truth be known, again, if we're threatened in our survival, that it takes a Herculean practice of awareness and discernment to actually own the perception as true or false. Because many people walk around feeling threatened and believing that they're right. And like Henry Ford said, whether you believe you can or believe you can't, in either case, you're right. So when we choose a particular perspective, we're going to filter information from the environment to reinforce our belief. And this is where it takes time to shift from a very cemented, codified belief system into a new one. This is what awakening experiences, particularly medicine work, help us do, is shift the ego enough so that there's this little opening so that you, I, we get to impregnate new habits, impregnate new belief systems, impregnate new activities that we practice again and again and again in order to create a new habit. Okay. So let's just unpack that again. Thought creates action. Action creates habit. Habit creates character. Character creates destiny. This also is not new science. This is the recapitulation of many wisdom teachings over thousands of years. It starts with our perspective. It starts with our belief. And belief can be codified, built on faith. Faith tends to be more at the soul level. Belief tends to be more at the mind level. And I'm not talking about ego. I'm talking about conscious mind and a centered awareness of what you choose to believe for your life. They're very complementary. Like, trust and faith are very complementary. Trust is more mind. Faith is more soul. It's a bit more substance or deep. So I want to just give a bit of summation to a lot of things we've covered up to this point, and now we're going to move into level two. So if we move up from the first level, which is safety and security, again, tends to be, you know, if we're looking energetically, most people at this point have seen a chakra system energetically, or in the energetic physiology, so to speak, would have that center be at the perineum, the root, kind of like at the base of the genitals. If we move up one level, then now we're in the second, and that's the center of creativity. And it's associated with our gonads, testes, and ovaries. This is where we create life. This is where humans create new life. This is also where we create for our lives. Creating offspring is just one manifestation. It's just one activity of this drive for creativity. So we have this drive for creativity, and the associated need at this level is freedom. That we have the freedom to create what it is ours to do. That we have the freedom to anchor ourselves in the awareness. This is where we start to impregnate new belief systems, if necessary, the awareness that we each are unique, that we're each a spark of the divine, so to speak, a fractal of the same creative force that spawned all life in the universe or in the multiverse. We come from that same seed of creation, all of us, all leaves fallen from the same tree. And the brilliance of these analogies is that the metaphorical accuracy of that vision, leaves fallen from the same tree, when you see them on the ground, they look separate, yet they've come from the same source. And when you look at each of those leaves, even though they've fallen from the same tree, they're all unique. Every leaf is unique. Every grain of sand is unique. Every snowflake is unique. That level of unique beauty in the multiverse is expressed also through each of us individually. And when you understand that and we really appreciate it, then it reinforces the fact that everybody's important. Everybody's life is important. Everybody's expression is important. Everybody anchoring into the empowered, safe, and secure position so that they can create with an experience of freedom, that which is theirs to do, that which is each of ours to do. This is a part of our, another word for that would be dharma. sacred service or like responsible duty, and not responsible like from your parents or family or culture or anybody else's expectations of you. It's not that kind of duty. It's the duty for your soul to be expressed. I know when I use the word soul, some people get a little fidgety because we're not exactly sure what that means. And yet again, all major medical institutions that have spanned time, that have written allegory, that have written codified protocols, that have written systems that have lasted until now, speak on soul. Soul translates in the Greek to mean psyche and vice versa. Psyche also translates to mean mind. When we start to unpack the potential reason that soul has been left out of medicine, that's a fairly large conversation and perhaps a little bit off topic. But a bit of a window into that is that over the last 100 years, allopathic medicine has gotten very good at creating new little widgets to try and solve multi-system problems. And you're never going to be able to create a pharmaceutical to fill a hole in the soul. So if you're here to be your beauty in the world, your genius in the world, your unique awesomeness in the world, if you're here to do that, then there are certain experiences in a human, in a body, that contribute to directly, that contribute to happiness. And they contribute to the experience of being on point with why you came in. Understanding more deeply over time, the clarity of the importance for you to be here as equal as anybody else and with a unique expression of creation to manifest and serve that's as important as anyone else. So this is a system to recognize that we're multidimensional beings, we're multi-leveled systems of complexity, and yet we're hardwired physiologically to require the same nutrients for life: water, oxygen, nutrition, sunlight, electromagnetics. We all use the same fuel to drive the hardware. And we're all codified in the same energetics of what we're here to experience and what contributes to either happiness or suffering. So we'll peel it back again, back to level 2, creativity and freedom. These are natural extensions, natural expressions of what it means to be a human. If we're not experiencing that, whether internally or externally, at the end of the day, it's all internal. And we can experience it as being external, because as we're reared from little beings up to adults, as little beings, we are dependent on our external environment. And so the ego starts to get constructed in its identity about being referenced and dependent on the external environment. As we age, as we mature, as we learn about life and ourselves, we start to reclaim that dependency as an independency and an interdependency as opposed to a codependency. And when somebody is weak or not fully inhabiting their second level energy body, their second level energy wheel, this power center at the second level that's around creativity and freedom, when somebody is not expressing that to a degree of health and vitality, that will come out as codependency. And that will look like stagnation. If you think of the creative experience, when it is withheld and stuffed and repressed, it looks like and expresses itself as stagnation. One example would be something like writer's block, right? If somebody's in a creative flow, and that, especially if that's what they do consistently, is drop into their creativity and drop into their flow, and all of a sudden it's not there, it feels like the water faucet just got turned off. It will feel like stagnation. It will express itself in that way. So complementary, right? So the drive is for creativity. We have this drive for creativity. You watch kids do this. You give kids the time to hang out and play with perceivably nothing to play with, they'll find something to do. They'll find sticks and rocks. They'll make up fun games. They're completely connected to their creativity if the adults and if the environment lets them be in that mode. That's the natural state, is creativity. That's the drive. The need in the expression of that creativity is freedom. And that's where the educational system has a lot of challenges, is the ability to teach young beings while allowing them to experience their freedom and express their creativity. We have a one-size-fits-all educational system based on making widgets that got essentially cemented in World War II. Because there are a lot of people making widgets. Like my grandma was, one of those, Rosie the Riveter. I don't remember if you ever saw those pictures, but she was a riveter, like a World War II bomber riveter. My grandma was on those assembly lines. That's how our educational system got codified. We need a lot of people to learn how to do something really fast in repetition. And it hasn't changed a whole lot since. There are particular systems that are not that rigid, like Montessori, like Waldorf school systems. There are a lot of complementary educational systems, and more people are now, either by choice or with COVID requirements, educating their kids at home. And when you do that at home, individually, you can more accurately assess the skill sets in that inherent individual and the ones to draw out, and to allow them the experience of being in their own evolution, in their own developmental arc, versus trying to fit their psychic structure into a codified system that's supposed to fit for everybody. So we can see just the educational system alone can start to impregnate the experiences of stagnation. If my flow is in this direction, and I'm being forced to express something over here. By the way, we all learn differently. Some people are visual, auditory, kinesthetic. Those are the three primary. There are other secondaries that can be even more important to a particular person. Because there's always outliers in the system, right? Some people are more interpersonal. They need to talk it out. They need to have the reference point to be able to solidify new information. Some people are more intrapersonal. They need to really go deep in themselves to insulate from the environment in order to understand it, make sense of it, and then experience it as truth. Some people are musical, like Mozart just came in as a musician. Some people just come in as musicians or hear lyrics related to information. These are just esoteric kind of examples of the fact that we're all super unique. Absolutely unique. And so if that need and drive for creativity and freedom is thwarted, that's going to look like stagnation. And it also starts to impregnate codependency. Because if my creative expression is gated by the external, like it's either allowed or not, like a faucet, you either turn it on or off. If something from the external is in control of that faucet, then I'm dependent on whether or not I feel either safe enough or empowered enough to turn it on myself if I can, to make the request that it gets turned on by whoever's quote unquote in control, or that I perceive as in control, or I let that happen on their side without understanding why or when it's going to occur. this is part of the nature of addiction, is when this center is blocked and we become codependent on something else to try and fill that hole. Addiction can come in at every level. This is just an example of how it comes in at the second level. Okay. So if we're in flow, and if you see somebody in the experience of that creative spark, then that's going to look like usually the things that are coming naturally, particularly to kids, in the expression of freedom and creativity. And so what would that look like? We already talked about one. And that one was specifically, like if you give kids the opportunity to just be together, what are you going to spontaneously see? Play. Yeah, you might see temper tantrums too. You might see whines. They're usually pretty brief. You might see power struggles, of course. But all of that is woven into the tapestry of play. That's the natural experience. Creativity with freedom looks like play. What does it look like for adults? Ideally, it still looks like play. But we as adults don't give us that. We typically don't give us ourselves that much time. And we start to get really rigid. And again, we've talked about longevity in the past too. Those centenarians that I've gotten to know, I don't know about you, but this is pretty consistent on my side. The centenarians that I've gotten to know, and this is also the data and the research too. Look at Mario Martinez's research on centenarians and blue zones. There's this spark. There's this like mischievous spark or something that's still in play. They're still in action. Their openness to life is still available. This is both openness in level one and freedom and expression and curiosity in level two. So adults, that's going to look like curiosity. The openness and the availability to see what new information can now come in that I get to create in the here and now. So they don't have the walls or the filters that think I've already gotten it all figured out. It also looks like movement and creative freedom and movement looks like what? Dance, music, singing. These are all expressions, healthy expressions of a vitalized second level energy center. And so now we start to build the appreciation of how these levels are working in concert to a whole codified human, to a system of conscious recognition of its multiplicity of parts. So when you have a system like this, a seven-layered system, it's convenient because there's a lot of information, but it's not so convenient that it feels overwhelming. Maybe it does, but I'm going to try and break it down. And you can get a sense like, okay, am I jamming on level one, two, maybe not three or four, but five, six, and seven? Okay, I've got like most of them. So it gives you more idea, more understanding of the levels to work on and to focus. We could take the approach that we're only as strong as our weakest link. Well, maybe we're only as happy as our least fed energy center. Or maybe we're only as happy as we can be, dependent on how much the energy center that's not getting done as much attention is able to move through us, is able to express through us. That drive and that need are not going to go away. And so oftentimes we will try and use activities and approaches related to the other levels that we might be jamming on, but that aren't necessarily going to fit that hole. Right? So for example, if we get into the appreciation that if we say you just drew pegs for each of these levels, say level one's a round peg, and level two is a square peg, and level three is a triangle, and level four is a star, and level five is a diamond, right? And we just work our way up the system. It's going to be hard to put that diamond-shaped peg into a round hole. It's going to be hard to use the same energetic at one level to fill the gap in the next. That's why we unpack a system like this. So you get the opportunity to see what's intact and what therefore, if not, needs to be served or that you would choose to serve. If we really want to look at conscious languaging, we don't need to do anything. I mean, we don't need to serve any of these needs or drives. We could just be a couch potato. You could just keep like doing the thing, even if you know that it's not healthy. We could do that for sure. That's our choice. That's free will choice. And what we do know is that when we inhabit consciously more of these parts of ourselves, we start to move in greater experiences of freedom, creativity, just at one level, right? So what is safety and security with freedom and creativity start to look like? And then next week we'll move into level 3, and then we'll move into level 4 and 5 and 6 and 7. And so this is building towards something. And these aren't mutually exclusive. We learn linearly, but it's not like you build level 1 and then you go to level 2. You don't graduate. These are all happening simultaneously in parallel. They're all needs and drives that we have at any given time throughout our life stream. From little tadpoles to the grave, from the womb to the tomb, these are the same consistent needs and drives. And when we understand that, now we have a system that can show us how we engage our life with more conscious choice and a greater acceptance of our own responsibility to do that which is ours to do, so that we can offer what we've come to do. Cool. So that wraps up level 2. You can put any questions in the chat box. I can answer those questions in this next section if it's related to that. Happy to do that. Or level 1. And we can also just riff on questions, because I think Megan and Sonia have a list of questions from our previous calls too. So Megan, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Dan. Amazing. Hey, we do have a question from last week, and then we can hop into a question from this week. Our question from last week is, when we're looking at the objective evil of the world, that which is founded in the intentional harm of others, such as violence, rape, etc., can we still think that the individual is acting in service of their needs and perpetrating generational trauma? Are there acts that are beyond retribution?
Ooh, the last part of that's really juicy. Are there acts beyond retribution? Sounds like the start of an awesome movie, or like the opening line of a really good book. That's a great question. And if you asked 100 people that question, you get 100 different answers. And so my opportunity that you've allowed for me in this relationship that we have is to do my best to ask questions to generate your reclamation and your claiming of your own truth. It's not my desire to give you a fish. It's my desire to, I mean, in that analogy, teach you to fish, or to just show you how to fish, or to like give you an example of a fish. But it's not, I don't want to put my truth onto yours and put my beliefs into like your hardware. Software. But what I will say is that when we get to a place of elevation, and what I mean is like elevated consciousness, and again, this isn't bad or good. It's tricky to use language that's not so dichotomized or divisive. These aren't good or bad terms. We're all on every side of the spectrum. When I talk about elevated consciousness, I'm talking about if you listen to the wisdom teachings come from all spiritual traditions. I've referenced this book before. I'll reference this book again. The book Oneness by Jeffrey Moses essentially looks at all the spiritual traditions and boils them down to the same tenets, the same codified teachings. And so if we look at those teachings in reference to this question, all acts are done by people believing in that moment that they're right, based in the consciousness and the information and the tools that they have at a given time. And if you're acting out of integrity, like if somebody's actually doing something they know is quote unquote wrong, then they're already in the position of taking care of that themselves. If somebody's doing something that they know is wrong, like at the core of their own being, nobody else is telling them it's wrong, they just know that it's wrong. When a person acts out of that degree of integrity for whatever reason, then there's going to be a seed in their consciousness that's going to provide the mirrored reflection of guilt. Guilt is actually helpful in that it helps us not do things consistently that are injurious to others without learning about the negative consequence. Guilt becomes a problem when we don't forgive ourselves and let it go, when we keep it going, so to speak, when we harbor it and carry it around with us for the rest of our lives. Like, for example, an affair. Somebody might be in the midst of an affair and they'll be like, I know this isn't right. And yet they're still engaging. That's not an easy yes or no answer. Is it right or it's wrong? That's a very complicated, very complex answer. And there's going to be an investigation on the internal landscape of that person to try and understand if what they're doing is justified. So we all go through this internal dialogue. Let me bring it back to the nature of this specific question. And if we want to get more into the weeds, then I'm happy to unpack it further. Is there evil in the world? How do I want to say this? Evil is not a force of creation. There's love, and then there's the distance from love. That's the dichotomy. That's not even the dichotomy. That's the complementary aspect. There's love, and there's the distance from it. And when we get further and further away from love, it looks like a lot of different things. It can look like greed, envy, resentment, hatred, bigotry, persecution, execution, the desire to end life because somebody has this distorted belief that whatever life is being ended isn't important anymore, or isn't rehabilitatable anymore. You guys know that I've been jamming on Michael Beckwith lately, and I just listened to his talk from April 4th of 2019, I think. I've just been like going through the archives because it's just like feeding me. And he mentioned a man named Gregory Clance, or that's not it, but it's something. There were two black men that were arrested and convicted of shooting a California Highway Patrol officer. And over the course of 17 years with life sentences, it was found out that the police coerced the witnesses, and they had, and what they had been saying along the whole time was true. That they were innocent. 17 years. And how many other people are in prison for similar reasons? For crimes they didn't commit? How many times have I committed a crime, not understanding its ramifications? A crime against another person, a crime against that person's humanity. We judge ourselves by our intentions, and we judge others by their actions. So from the get-go, it's not a completely objective filter. And this is where we take ownership. And if we look at the core wound, all right, we've talked about this in the past, and I'll just unpack it really briefly now, but perhaps we'll offer it in a longer conversation. Five Core Wounds of the Soul. This is Lise Bourbeau's work. Rejection, abandonment, humiliation, betrayal, and injustice. Not necessarily in that order, but oftentimes. Usually one of those, maybe more, will get codified and stuck in the soul psychic matrix like a splinter. And that core wound will fester and it will negatively impact our experience of safety and security or creativity and freedom or love and bonding or all of the primary drives. Our wounds influence our drives. They influence our needs. Sometimes we can tell ourselves whether or not we actually deserve to fulfill that drive and the need in the first place. When we look at those five wounds of the soul, they're complements. Rejection, when we take ownership and heal that core wound, that now starts to look more and more like power. Rejection turns into power. And when we're in our power, it's much harder to be rejected. Because we just recognize that we're in our power, you're in your power, I have my truth, you have your truth. Awesome. Dope. And I become more and more centralized into the experience of the awesomeness of who I am. And so that if I'm rejected by another, it doesn't hurt as much. But as a child, being rejected can be crushing, especially if it comes from one of the parents or the primary caregivers. Because the primary caregivers for a little being are the whole universe. And if you get rejected by the universe, that's a hard one to get over. Right? So rejection, abandonment. What does abandonment look like? The complement to that is, well, now we're getting a bit into the, I guess I'm going to unpack the whole system. Abandonment looks like commitment. So the complement to abandonment starts to look more and more like, yeah, I was abandoned. And like Sonia can tell you this, like my core wound in this lifetime has been abandonment. And it wasn't abandonment like by anybody's fault. I was born 6 weeks early. I ended up with not fully developed lungs on a ventilator with recurrent pneumonia for the most of my first year of life. And at some point, I think the little me was like, what the fuck? Who's what's this tube in my throat? Where's everybody at? Where's the boob? Where's people? And I just locked it down. And I said, you know, I'm going to take care of me then. It's just me. Like, I'm thinking, like, you know, I don't know. What does a newborn's little internal dialogue look like? It's probably like, hey, dude, you and I, let's lock it down and take care of business. And commitment's been the hardest thing for me to get around and to own and to start to inhabit. And that's been my primary life lesson. We all have our own primary life lessons. I'm just giving you a little example so that you know that this isn't like an altar or a podium. This is a circle. We are in circle. We are in community. We are in co-created dialogue. I just happen to be in the offered position to share information. So again, rejection, abandonment, humiliation. What does humiliation look like? Well, the complement to humiliation is going to be truth. Same kind of thing as rejection and power. If somebody humiliates me or I'm humiliated by something I did or somebody like projects their judgment on me in a way that feels humiliating. If I'm in my truth, the more and more I claim my truth, the less and less that wound has a negative impact on my drives and needs. So we're just slowly unpacking the whole thing. Right? The reason I wanted to get to this place is that I wanted to speak about, rejection, abandonment, humiliation, betrayal. Right? What does betrayal look like? That looks like integrity in its complement. Like if I'm betrayed, I have the opportunity to actually do, this is also human alchemy, alchemy of the mind. When I'm wounded at that core level or I'm re-experiencing the core wound, I have the ability with consciousness to claim its complementary opposite. So if somebody betrays me, the steepest growth curve that I can experience in that moment is actually to claim my integrity back. And to know that if I'm integrity to the best of my ability, then that betrayal is on that person. And oh, by the way, forgiveness is for you. It's not for the other person. So if there's forgiveness that needs to happen, I'm doing that on my side, that so that if there is a betrayal or some kind of wrong, I'm not holding it on. It's not twisting me out for however long. I get to forgive that person. They've got their own karma. They've got their own thing going on. Even if it feels, quote unquote, evil, betrayal can feel evil. And this gets to the last one, injustice. This is why I want to unpack that whole system and get to point five. Because point five in its complement, in the experience of justice, right? In the experience of injustice, I get to claim the right relationship to justice through empathy. And that's where I get to put myself in that person's position. So to get around this whole topic is a great question. When I can put myself better and better in other people's shoes, then I get more and more empathically connected to the potential reason that they thought what they were doing was right or justified. Again, this is not the example when somebody consciously knows that they're doing something that's not ideal. It's like when somebody is like Hitler, like let's take the grand example, Hitler and the Nazi regime, genocide, or the Hutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda. That was a lot longer ago. That's like in our lifetime. 800,000 people were butchered. Is it 800 or 80? I think it was 800,000 people were butchered in like 90 days. Some, I don't know, the stats are totally right on that, but it's some horrendous amount of savagery. And the work to do that has been the reconciliation movement, largely spearheaded by Desmond Tutu. And if you know him, he's like the Dalai Lama, you know, he just exudes this sweetness and this love. So if we were to have a conversation with Desmond, Archbishop Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and ask him that same question, is there evil? I think he'd have some pretty brilliant answers around that. And I expect that it would look something like what we're talking about. Because there was some distortion in that person's field, in the Hutus that were butchering the Tutsis. There was some distortion in their appreciation of humanity and their inability to see that person as another person. And even if they saw that person as another person, then the ability to see that person's life with importance or value. Or with Hitler and the Nazis, to see the Jews as expendable. And not only expendable, but like it was the Nazis' duty to exterminate the Jews. I mean, how distorted is that? And there were a lot of people that jumped on the bandwagon. When you understand the backstory even more, Germany was in shatters after World War I. And then you had Hitler come in and give everybody something to rally around. Well, the way that we get conscripted into distorted ways of thinking is that we're expressing a core wound. And the core collective wound was being healed through the promise of this very vibrant speaker. I mean, if you look at Hitler's speeches, he's just like on fire. And with somebody who's just been shattered, or a culture or a collective that's just been shattered, to have somebody come in and say, we claim our power back. We claim our identity back. We claim our sovereignty, right? It built up the shattered psyche of the German people. And so when you understand it, and we have more compassion and more empathy and more ability to see it from the other position, then it starts to lessen the drive for such intense expressions of justice. I heard recently a translation of justice essentially meaning love that happens in the public arena. Justice is love that happens in the public arena. Whoa. That's an exalted expression of justice. Through compassion, through empathy. It doesn't mean we don't hold people accountable, for sure. Is it good that we have a war tribunal looking at people that have done horrendous things because of their own distorted position to many people? Yes, it's so important to hold people accountable. Because if we don't, then we're also culpable. We can hold, but they don't have to live separately. In our culture, they tend to live separately. Justice tends to be divorced from empathy. And when we can start to bring them closer together and start to appreciate what is ours to do, to see our family of humanity, Dolly, I'll just bring it to, and I'll wrap up this part. If we want to look at an avatar on truth and reconciliation, in addition to Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Tutu is the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. When China invaded, if you want a cool movie, check out Kundun, which is essentially like his life. Really well done. And it shows China invading Tibet. It shows him fleeing. It shows him going to Dharamsala, India, to essentially be in asylum, political asylum, in a place that he could be safe. And somebody asked him once, like, are the Chinese, and right now China's still doing horrendous things to Tibet. They just like kidnapped a Karmapa and put their own person, like the person that's gonna lead Tibet after the Dalai Lama leaves. The Karmapa's job is to find the next Dalai Lama. And now China has essentially just come up with their own. Somebody asked him, you know, essentially, is China evil? And he said, you know, it's our karma. Because a long time ago, Tibet invaded China. And I was like, to be able to just own our love, regardless of what anybody and my ego want to tell me is right. To be able to own love and forgiveness, still hold people accountable, and to still come back to the language of the soul, which is the essence that has created all life in the universe, and that is love. Love is the creative force that has spawned all life. It's the core of all wisdom traditions. It's the core of all spiritual traditions. That's not just a coincidence. It all comes back to that very simple yet marvelously complex term. Because most of us weren't taught what unconditional love means. So we have a lot of interpretations.
Thank you all for saying yes to this work and for your willingness to go deeper. As always, it is a pleasure to spend this time with you, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter, if you haven't already, on our Full Spectrum Medicine website. We would love to stay in touch. Thank you all so much for joining us, and we wish you a beautiful, happy, and healthy week ahead.